If you haven't already, explore the many ways to connect with our show. Watch full uncut conversations on YouTube, gain AIA-approved continuing education credits through Arcademy, and make sure to check us out and follow us on social media at Detailed Podcast. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
When you open up or touch an old building and you find something that's not necessarily documented in any drawings, and then you adapt to it. And when they started excavating for the new building, for the expansion, there was a moment when they found bones, large bones in the ground. And everyone had to stop, obviously. We didn't know what it was. The police, St. Louis police, was investigating, and it turns out it was the remains, almost as old as the original building, 100 years old, of dogs. There was remains of several dogs. That was a creepy moment where everyone had to stop work for, 2 days.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guest today is Takashi Tournier, AIA, architect and director of Snohetta's New York studio. Snohetta has offices all over the world. Was going to list them, too many offices all over the world. Takashi is a licensed architect and director at Snohetta's New York studio with 20 plus years of experience. Since joining the firm in 2009, he has led diverse projects across cultural, institutional, residential, and master planning scales. His recent work includes leading the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra renovation and expansion, which opened in the fall of 2025, and the Soundview Recreation Center in New York City. Takashi also led the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts. Prior to Snohetta, he worked with Shop Architects in New York and Tadao Ando in Japan. The project we are talking about today, if you haven't guessed it already, is the recently opened St. Louis Symphony Orchestra's Powell Hall in St. Louis, Missouri. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Marking its centennial in 2025, the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra is ushering in a new era for its historic home, Powell Hall. Part of this transformation is a massive overhaul and modernization of the structure while honoring the initial design and its many changes over the last century.
The client is the symphony in St. Louis. It is actually a very old symphony. It's the second oldest in the country. They are around since 1880, and it's the second after the New York Philharmonic. The symphony, when they started in 1880, they were in a different venue, and since then they moved to various venues within St. Louis until 1968, when they moved into their current home, which is called Powell Hall, the building. It's a historic building that started its life as a vaudeville movie palace. So it was not a purpose-built concert hall. It was a movie palace built in 1925, so exactly 100 years ago. And it was designed by Chicago theater architects, Rapp & Rapp. And that firm, Rapp & Rapp, designed many theaters all across the country. We have several still here in New York. The King's Theater in Brooklyn is very famous. It was also renovated recently. So that became their home in 1968. They moved in. That was sort of the first transformation of that building. The acoustics were already fairly good, and they were further improved at that time. They made adjustments to the seats. There were way more seats before when it was a movie theater, and they reduced it to about 2,600 seats at the time. And then fast forward, the symphony has used that venue, you know, since 68 without a lot of changes. And they really came to the point where they had to go through another large, major transformation to really change the building or make it really fit for the future for a modern symphony for all their needs. And that's kind of where we came in. Even before having the interviews, this was an interview process. We competed with two other firms at the end, were invited for this interview. But the symphony already had ideas, what they wanted and needed, and they engaged two other firms even before the architects. So they worked with theater planners, and they worked with an acoustician. It was Schuler Schuck from Chicago. They're the theater planners. And then Kierkegaard, the acoustician, Brian Corey, he's local, he's from St. Louis. He already spent years kind of, you know, understanding, trying to understand what needs to happen to the hall to even improve the already good acoustics further. And then the same for the theater planners. They work with the symphony on all their needs, especially for the backstage areas. And when you look at the building, it was a movie palace. So it never really had a backstage area. There were no dressing rooms there. There were no practice rooms. So the symphony for decades made use with every space they could find in the building. There's anecdotes about musicians playing in the basement, you know, practicing in boiler rooms, changing either at home or quickly in a restroom even. So it wasn't really adequate, but they made perfect use of it and got to this point where they really thought about expanding outside the footprint, adding those necessary program elements and making it fit for the future. And that's where we came in. And that's about 6 years ago. The interview was in 2019. We formed a large team. This was a large team of specialists, lots of specialists beyond acoustics and theater planners. There were, you know, lighting, there was theatrical lighting, there was regular architectural lighting, there was, you know, landscape, which is covered by our office. As you might probably know, Snohetta is both. We're both landscape architects and architects, and we usually collaborate on every project. So our office work beyond the building on the site planning as well. Yeah, this is how it started, and it's been a long process, about 6 years. We typically start working through a series of larger, like master planning and visioning phases, then into concept before we go into basic services.
The design of the project was twofold: to modernize Powell Hall itself, and to realize the front of house and back of house expansion, an ambitious 65,000 square foot addition that brings the total project to 189,130 square feet.
The scope of the project has two parts, basically, two categories. One, obviously, is the modernization of Powell Hall, this 100-year-old movie palace, former movie palace, you know, bringing that up to current standards, current codes, life safety, accessibility, and comfort. And then beyond that, the second component is the expansion that we designed, and basically all the program elements that did not really, were either missing or didn't fit into the existing building. Those happen in the expansion. And the expansion itself has kind of a front of house portion, and has a back of house, a backstage. And then one other significant component that was kind of desired by the client was a multipurpose and a rehearsal room. So until now, the symphony rehearsed inside the main hall. And they didn't have a second venue. So that was another important component of the expansion.
Located among other historical theater structures in the Grand Center, the reduction of other venues over the years provided an opportunity for the symphony to expand on its original site.
Powell Hall is located within a larger theater district, an arts district in St. Louis. It's called the Grand Center, and the Grand Center is sort of lined up around Grand Boulevard, hence the name. There used to be even more theaters in the past. Currently, you know, there's the Fabulous Fox Theater is another large venue, also converted movie theater into a concert venue. And the area used to be much denser. So over the last decades, buildings have disappeared. Adjacent to our building, Powell Hall, the immediate buildings were torn down over time. So there were lots available right next to the building that were used as surface parking lots, really. And the symphony acquired those lots and combined them. And that's where we physically expanded the building. So we're located on a corner lot on Grant Avenue and Del Mar. And Del Mar to the north, Grant to the west. So the natural ways to expand were to the south of the building and to the east. And to the east, right to the back of the fly tower. So that was naturally going to be the direction for the backstage expansion. One of the large moves urbanistically that we made was the decision to expand on the south side, but move the expansion or set it back from Grant Boulevard to create a plaza, an urban plaza that, you know, has many functions. It could be a space for gathering before a show. It could even be used for small performances outdoors. So something that didn't exist previously. You know, previously you would enter the building right under a canopy from a very narrow sidewalk. So now there's actually room now to breathe and to gather before you enter the building. And that said, we moved the entrances, we moved the main entrance into the expansion, and we closed off the old entrance. That was kind of a difficult decision because, you know, in the memory of many people that have been going to the symphony for a long time, that was always the entrance. And, you know, they would naturally go there. But I think with this large gesture that we made, creating this plaza and pulling it back, and it is very intuitive now to enter the building. So that's one big feature. Other features are a drop-off. There was no formal drop-off before. Now there's a drop-off that's integrated into the site plaza on the south side. We have reconfigured the parking. You know, people still arrive mostly by cars at the symphony and other theaters in the area. And we have created some landscape features that deal with stormwater management and so on. So part of our sustainability ideas there.
Snohetta's vision establishes a thoughtful dialogue between old and new, finding continuity in the curved geometries of both the hall and the instruments it houses. The exterior's canted masonry shells and arched openings reinterpret the historic vocabulary through a modern lens.
St. Louis is a masonry, it's a brick city. Most of the buildings in the Grand Center are built with brick. You know, Powell Hall is a brick building. Some parts of the facade are terracotta, but the majority is brick. So it was fairly clear early on that we'll work with the same material. But in terms of scale and size and shape, form, we made some choices that made the building more complementary to the existing building. So it was important to us to kind of preserve that iconic look of the original building and create something that's a partner to it, but that doesn't mimic it, that's got its own identity. And there's people in my office that called the expansion a dance partner. So something that really belongs together. They're dancing together. They're not stepping on their toes, but they have their discrete characters. So that's what we did. The expansion is relatively small when you look at it. It's sort of leaning against the original building. It's shorter in height. So from most views, the original silhouette is preserved. It's not, you know, overpowered with the expansion. One other thought that we had was the original building kind of felt very introverted or hermetic. You know, it had this like big formal facade on Grand. It's almost like a Roman Greco style facade with arched openings. But then it also had three blank facades in the back. And you really had to enter to see, you know, this magnificent space on the interior. And for the expansion, we thought about complementing it and almost turning it into an inside-out approach, where we took some of that playful language of the hall and brought it to the exterior. So the original building is, again, almost like a extruded rectangle, a box. And we created an expansion that had curves in the facade, that had a facade that was slightly leaning. So it had a very distinguished geometry. And at the same time, it had to be buildable out of brick, had to be relatively simple construction. Obviously, everyone has a budget. We had a budget to meet here too. We try to see if there's more innovative ways to work with brick. And one idea was to create the exterior almost out of curved shells that are, you know, when you look at it in the abstract, they're parts of a leaning cylinder. So a cylinder that's kind of like tilted to its side. When you cut horizontal sections through it, so every brick coursing is actually the same radius as you march up the building. So that was something that we achieved, and we worked through with the mason. And they were able to build it, you know, without many questions asked. There was not a whole lot of RFIs. It worked surprisingly nice and came out very, very beautiful. There were some tricky moments. The arched openings that we created, those have concealed what's called a concealed lintel system. So that had to be engineered, and that was one of the more challenging facade features. Custom corner pieces. We thought about doing these custom angled corners from the factory. But then after some tests, we saw that during the firing process, you know, brick shrinks, these angles actually change, and it's less accurate. So we work again with the mason and used a cut brick that was then epoxied together, and it actually created a much cleaner geometry at these custom corners.
Within, a triple height gathering space organizes circulation vertically and visually. Terraces overlap and overlook one another, producing an architecture of exchange with spaces that enable visitors to witness the collective ritual of performance even before entering the hall itself.
We deliberately designed entrances on every facade. We wanted to open up the building on all sides and activate the facade. So I mentioned earlier, the building had one formal facade, and it had three almost like blank facades previously. Now two of those facades are activated with the expansion. We also convinced the symphony to introduce a new entrance on the north side, a small entrance that kind of opens up and looks out to the community to the north of us. Del Mar, which is the street on the north of the building, is a large socioeconomic divide within the city. And we really wanted to create a gesture, an invitation to that side of the community too. And that plus a lay-by, a drop-off, kind of activated that facade. There's now views through the building in that direction. But coming back to the expansion, so the expansion has two new entrances, one from the plaza and one from the opposite side facing the parking. And that will be a direction that many people will take to get into this new lobby. The new lobby is a large triple height space. It has two stacked or terraced lobby floors that correspond to balcony levels inside the hall. With the expansion on the south side, obviously we changed how you enter the building and how you get to your seat finally. Everything used to be just happening from the Grand Boulevard side. Now we're also adding a new way to get into the building from the south side. So as you step in, probably the first thing that you notice is a sculptural stair. It's almost a sculpture that connects the open terraces. One of the things that's important in this type of building, and you know, that the old building already had in its lobby, is the aspect of see and be seen. You know, like you're going to a concert hall, not just to enjoy music, but it's a social space. It's a space where people arrive early and they want to meet their friends and they want to see and be seen. So expanding that on the south side and giving more opportunities for that aspect was part of the design.
The enhanced lobby and back of house areas now integrate improved circulation, educational facilities, and re-envisioned spaces for the musicians, expanding the hall's capacity to serve as both a world-class performance venue and a community anchor.
I should start with Powell Hall again, the historic building, which used to be a movie theater, and you know, it has a great lobby and an amazing space that, and we read it was modeled after the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. So it's this like grand, almost Baroque space with a big stair and chandeliers, multiple balconies, but it was very tight. Like the square footage was small. It never had enough space to accommodate all of the 2,600 patrons. So what we heard is there was always this kind of joke. During intermission, you could either get a drink if you're patient enough and wait in line, or you could use the restrooms, but you could never do both things at once. You know, the 15 minutes were not enough to do that. And that was kind of the starting point for us to think about, you know, the amenities and where to place these amenities in the new lobby. And the principle is very simple. We try to locate the bars that you mentioned, the concessions, as close and central as possible so that people can reach them from every seat without changing levels. You know, like every balcony level would have a corresponding lobby and a concession and restrooms and other amenities right there. And that was kind of driving the organization of those front of house spaces. It seems to be a common issue with concert halls or this type of venue. You know, you can never have enough of either. Yeah, previously there were two concessions. One of them was a mobile concession, and we added three major concession bars in the new building. And there's a donor lounge, a separate lounge that has its own concession bar as well. And there's about 100 musicians at the symphony, and they come together. They have what's called a musician's lounge. So they use that space every day. You know, that's where they have the coffees and they celebrate birthdays and so on. It used to be one of their basement spaces previously. Obviously, that's not what, you know, what anyone wanted. So they have now one of the nicest spaces that is actually facing east, has lots of natural daylight, and it looks out towards downtown St. Louis. And even in the background, you see the arch, you know, the world famous arch. That's their space. And, you know, we asked the question, like, where do you want to be, like, early on? And they kind of point like, oh, we'd like to be here in this corner, and we want to have this, and we want to, they all have their individual cups. They have 100 coffee cups with, you know, people with their names on it, with a slogan or something, but it's very individual. And in their old room, they had a corner where they were kind of like displaying it haphazard. So we thought that'll be a nice design feature. We're going to design you a little shelf for your cups, for your 100 cups, and you can display them. So that became a feature in that room. Just to kind of highlight, you know, like the front of house, the spaces that we created, the lobby, you know, the concessions and all that for the audience, all of that is important, but it all doesn't really work if there's not a really, really well-functioning backstage area, back of house area. And so we spent a lot of attention on that, and we worked again with all the specialists, the theater planners, but also the musicians themselves to organize that space as rational as we can. And you brought up daylight. Daylighting was one of the strategies to introduce as much daylight as possible. So all the practice rooms, the major practice rooms, have windows out towards Del Mar. Urbanistically, it also puts eyes on the street as a safety aspect of it. And, you know, you see that the building is activated, you know, the facade is activated, windows, lights are on. That was all very, very important when we planned the back of house.
The renovation reimagined the auditorium with more generous seating and integrated micro-graded ramps throughout the structure, making accessibility and inclusion central to the design experience.
It was an amazing space 6 years ago when we saw it. It's still amazing, and you know, there's a lot of love for it, and people are very attached to the space, the materials, the finishes, you know, everything beyond the acoustics. The acoustics are already very, very nice. And there was a fear that, you know, any intervention would take away from that. So we had to be very, very careful and do it in a very discreet way. So, for example, we had 2,600 seats in there, but those seats were designed in 1968. So they were quite tight for today's comfort, and sidelines were not optimal. You know, the aisles were narrow. So we decided together with the theater planners and the symphony to remove seats and to lower the count around 400. So now the seats are wider. They're still in a very similar, they look very similar. They're still, you know, red velvet, slightly different red, but they're all new seats. They're comfortable to a point where the client even asked for cup holders. You can have your opinion about it, but it's something that they wanted, and that's integrated. But the big change and the really challenging part of the modernization of that hall is to integrate or to make it accessible, really. And that was not a thought in 1925 for sure, and then even in 1968 it was not a main concern. So we had to be very careful with regrading parts of the orchestra floor. So we did some micrograding in there to achieve the ramps, to achieve accessible ramps, to eliminate steps that were there. We had to introduce new cross aisles and everything, so without disturbing the character of the hall. So you know, when you squint your eyes, you notice it's slightly different, but it still feels the same as before and all along. But there's also the other aspect of accessibility to the building in general and to this typology of a symphony. And the symphony has worked a long time on this, and they've had great ideas about expanding the audience and you know, attracting new audience to a symphony by offering, you know, different types of music, changing their program. So they've done a whole lot of that kind of accessibility. But what we hope to deliver was making a building that is more welcoming and inviting and kind of removes that barrier of entering a building. You know, previously you really had to buy a ticket and then walk through a very tight box office until you got into, you know, the lobby and then the hall. So many people wouldn't even, and we like to not only talk to our clients, we meet a lot of people during the process. You know, we sometimes even talk to an Uber driver that takes us from the airport to the project and ask them for their experience and have they ever been to the symphony. And many people say, well, I know that the symphony is there, but I've never really been there, or, you know, there's something that didn't make it accessible for everyone. And we try to change that with the architecture, with a building that is more extroverted, more inviting, more open, has a grand entrance that you walk in even without a ticket. So the ticket box office is actually kind of inside the main lobby. The main lobby is open at all times during the day. So, you know, it kind of sparks an interest. People are naturally exploring, walking into the building, even seeing the grand stair, and then deciding, oh, I want to see a show here. So it's that kind of accessibility too that we try to address with architecture, with the building, with, you know, some of the design decisions that we made. And that is really the mission of the symphony. Even before we came on board, you know, this is something that they were very interested in achieving, you know, like music for all, welcoming all, being very inclusive to all communities. They achieved a lot just by making these connections. But then, you know, this was their chance with the physical transformation of the center to do it as well.
Finishes were kept in tone with the original materials of the building, including warm woods, red velvet, and champagne metal in between the thresholds connecting the spaces.
The existing building is extremely opulent, rich. It has velvet and dark wood and a lot of gold and beige colored walls. So it's got its own palette, a very rich palette. We obviously took cues from that. We were inspired by it, but we tried to reduce our palette so that it's, you know, very clear where you are. You are either in the expansion, you're going back into the other world. It's between two worlds, basically. And we limited ourselves to a handful of materials, really, on the interiors in the expansion. So there's a lot of plaster. There's terrazzo throughout for the floors. It's a very durable, elegant material. And we use wood, natural wood, but not as dark as in the existing building. We used white oak veneers along the concessions. We had some walls behind the concession ceilings. But we didn't use it. We used it very carefully, and we used it as a wayfinding tool, too. So from a distance, as you look into the lobby from the outside, you kind of spot these moments that are rendered in wood and understand, you know, those are amenities, those are special places to go to, a special public program. And it's also something that you want to walk up to and touch and feel. So that's why we use wood there. There's one more material, an important material. Everywhere where we had a threshold between the existing building and the new building, the connections, those are typically framed in a metal, in a champagne-colored, kind of a lighter version of the historic gold. So it's a champagne color. And we use that also for the soffits over the arched windows, the arched openings into the expansion. So those are also champagne-colored metal.
The adaptive reuse strategy modernized the historic building to align with current sustainability standards, featuring an improved thermal envelope and fully replaced MEP systems.
By reusing an old building, adaptive reuse, you know, that alone, and just giving this 100-year-old building a new life, or extending its life, I think that alone is a huge sustainability, or part of the sustainability strategy here. Obviously, the new addition is, you know, meeting the code, is beyond code. It's airtight and well insulated and all that. But we did replace all the mechanical systems. Obviously, those were outdated, state-of-the-art systems. We built a separate plant in a basement to the east of the building in the addition that is serving the old building and the new building. The air is a displacement air system. So it's delivered from below the concert hall floor at a very low velocity. So it's nice and quiet. So that reduces the energy consumption significantly. The old building is separated from the expansion. So there's a fire separation, which was one of the major challenges. You know, on one hand, we wanted to connect the buildings and stitch them together as good as we can. But there is a 3-hour rated facade separation between the two. You know, to overcome that, we had to use horizontal fire curtains and so on that seamlessly retracted in walls, so you don't see it every day. But, you know, something that just made the building and the construction quite complicated. The systems, the upgrades to the mechanical systems, that's one big part of it. The old building, the hall had, you know, not the latest generation of lighting, theatrical lighting and house lighting. So everything is obviously low energy LED system now. Also generating less heat overall, so there's less of a load to deal with. We did replace all the windows on the east facade facing Grand. Those are windows and doors, emergency egress doors. Those are all brand new wood doors. They're much more tight. There's new seals in there. We had an acoustic problem. So the building previously had egress straight out to the north and the south. They were cast iron steel stairs. They're without a sound and light lock. So, you know, in case of a fire, people would just like open up the door and leave the building straight out to exterior stairs, egress stairs. So that was a source of noise, but also of air leakage. So those doors are replaced. There's new gaskets in there that made a big difference. The roof has some updates in the flight tower, which is actually occupied by some of the offices. The administration is located within the flight tower. That was part of the 1968 transformation. That has been replaced. Windows have been updated there. So overall, subtle updates to the building, but with a significant effect on energy and noise. You know, what we've heard is previously you know, an ambulance would go by, or somebody would just, a speeding car would go by, and you could hear it inside the hall, which is absolutely something, you know, you don't want in a symphony.
While striking a balance between modernization and the preservation of the hall's original charm, the process revealed a number of unexpected design challenges.
Just working on a building that is 100 years old, and especially one that's, you know, this complex by itself is extremely challenging. The biggest challenge, just stepping back from a design perspective, is finding this appropriate approach to scale and kind of form and language to complement a building with that stature. So I think that's something that we worked very hard on, and we had many, many different studies until it kind of became a series of these curved shells that are creating the expansion. It was pretty clear from the beginning that this has to be a masonry building. We're going to have the same DNA as the existing building, but we're going to use the brick in a different way, in a complementary way. So that was probably a big challenge. And then there was small challenges all along, you know, all the unexpected. When you open up or touch an old building and you find something that's not necessarily documented in any drawings, and then you adapt to it. And when they started excavating for the new building, for the expansion, there was a moment when they found bones, large bones in the ground. And everyone had to stop, obviously. We didn't know what it was. The police, St. Louis police, was investigating, and it turns out it was the remains, almost as old as the original building, 100 years old, of dogs. There was remains of several dogs. That was a creepy moment where everyone had to stop work for, you know, 2 days. And then the other story, yes, also a shock that happened was, you know, again, an old building, 100 years old, and that building, you know, has a life of its own, and it changes. And, you know, you have good surveys, and we have done 3D surveys on the interior. We have surveyed the exterior, but we haven't surveyed all of the facades all the way up. So we found out when they were setting up the expansion coordinates on the side, they found out that the building actually twisted over time. The entire building twisted, and one of the facades was leaning out. And we had an issue with the lot line, and we had to, this was, you know, during construction, early construction, we had to go back into our model, everyone, all consultant structure, everyone, and start shifting the building on one end 5 inches. 5 inches doesn't sound a whole lot, but it is, that was a shock, and we thought this is going to be a big problem, but we all worked through it.
The construction process presented a considerable challenge in navigating the symphony's busy performance schedule.
One of the biggest challenges was schedule. You know, like the construction phase took only I say only because given the complexity that we're dealing with, 2.5 years is not a long time. So it's faster than what we see in other projects, really. And that had to do with the symphony's seasons. So we really had to plan around the seasons all along throughout the design phase too, but especially during construction, because that was the time when the symphony moved out of their venue and they were in temporary spaces. And just financially, they couldn't afford to not be operational, you know, within this time. And they reopened now for this fall season. So there was absolutely no option to extend the schedule, and everybody had to do whatever they could to stay on schedule. So that was a challenge for not only the contractors and the construction team, but all of us.
For Takashi, the project's success stemmed from a spirit of humility, listening carefully to musicians, stakeholders, and collaborators, and nurturing the creative dialogue that united them.
I would say, And you know, maybe this is true for many projects, but for this one especially, it was such a large group of stakeholders, of experts that I work with, b- both on the client side and our design team side, we really learn how to listen, how to ask the right questions, and, you know, not come with preconceived solutions. It's really sitting down with the musicians, with people that operate a symphony for decades, and finding, you know, the solutions together. I think that was something that we did early on, and it was really, really, really helpful. And, you know, we'll do this on every project to some extent, but I think we really did the right thing here. And it was tough because we started this project during the pandemic too. So a lot of these meetings didn't happen in person. It was like kind of like when everyone got used to the Zoom communication. It was interesting. It was an interesting start of a project. But I think we all learned a lot about communication, about working with a large, diverse client group, building consensus, but also having them being part of a design process. Kind of like, you know, we like to have these like very early exercises where we sit together with stakeholders and have them sometimes come up with an idea. And, you know, anyone that is part of this team, you know, can have the best idea. It doesn't necessarily need to be one of us on the architecture side. So we try to engage everyone. And, you know, the outcome was that there was a lot of kind of robust feedback and buy-in into ideas that helped us all the way, even through construction, when, you know, decisions had to be made, or things had to be substituted, or God forbid there's a VE moment where costs had to be reduced. But at least there were stakeholders that were already advocating for an idea and they wanted something. And early on, it helped everyone. You know, as much as we listen and learn from the symphony, and it wasn't only the board members, but they were, you know, the symphony was open enough to bring in representatives from the musician side, from other involved trades. So it was a mix, a very mixed group of specialists, and we learned as much from them as they learned from us about the process.
In uniting restoration with expansion, Snohetta's design frames Powell Hall as both artifact and instrument. The renewed concert hall not only elevates the experience of performance, but extends an open invitation to the community, celebrating 100 years of music while composing the next movement in its architectural story. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. One of the bigger issues in our industry for architects is managing client expectations in order to meet project budgets and schedules. I was curious what Takashi thought are best practices to help clients stay on the same page and have reasonable expectations.
Managing client expectations is probably one of the most critical and difficult aspects of our work. We like to start projects like this with a visioning phase or a master planning phase. You know, it's less about a design. It's more about developing a vision or a strategy and really kind of educating the client, but also learning from the client during that time to arrive, you know, at a project and to understand exactly what the expectations are on their side, and also involving outside consultants early on, such as, we don't call them cost consultants necessarily, it's more like a cost modeler at that point, where you can kind of benchmark budgets and construction budgets and kind of work with the client together to see, you know, how much program is appropriate and for this type of project early on, that there's no surprises later. And what we like to avoid, obviously, is you know, where the expectations are not aligned between us, all of us, and we need to then later phases value engineer or remove program or something like that. You know, that's always a bad start in our opinion. So to avoid that, we like to, you know, all get on the same page early on. We like to work with these cost consultants who know us well. They know when we do a rough sketch, they know, you know, this is XYZ cost, and they can help educate the client too. I'll give you an example. Here's an interesting thing. We did this on this project. You know, everyone was on board. The budget was the budget. And at some point, and this may have to do with the pandemic, the costs were kind of like spiraling. And, you know, there was, as everyone knows, supply chain issues and things and inflation, and things became more expensive. And someone asked the question, now, is there a way to simplify the building? Is the architecture or the geometry, the shape of the building making the cost go up and making this building expensive? And we always try to tell people, you know, the biggest contributor to cost is program. It's the size of the building. It's not exactly how it looks and whether it's curved or not. But they didn't believe us. So we went and created a very simplified scheme. We called it the straw man scheme. So we created a very boxy scheme where every wall was just straight, planar, and everything was rectangular. And then we had it priced by the general contractor. So we were working with a GC early on, even during design phases, and they were providing cost input. It turns out the simplified scheme was only 5% cheaper than what we proposed. So the client went back and said, like, well, no, we don't want this. We want the building that we've seen all along, that our donors and others in the community wants.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Takashi. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires the mark that you want to leave on this world.
My impact is not measured necessarily, you know, by the projects that you know I help create with others, many others. You know, today I'm only speaking, but you know, I'm just one of many that worked on this project. But I think it's about how a project like this or any other project that we create impacts people's lives and you know, their experience of the world. I think that's more important than the object, the architecture of the building itself. I think like what really, how it contributes to the environment and the community where it is.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.